Is that all right? That's one of my favorite movies of all time. And those of you who are too young to even remember it, I feel for you. That's one of the disadvantages of being young. I don't know what this paper up here is. I'm putting it over here. Not part of what I'm supposed to deal with. I got enough. There are some people in this room that are incredibly dear to my heart. And I'm not going to say any more than that. I'm going to tell you a story about a 2,000-year-long story. Yeah, we're going to be here a while. And I'm dedicating this story to that 52% of the working force in this country who don't take all of their vacation. I want to talk to them about pleasure. The story begins on the island, the Greek island of Samos, about 300 years before Christ. You're thinking, oh yeah, the island of Samos, that's Pythagoras. A squared plus B squared equals C squared, that stuff. No, I'm not talking about Pythagoras. He was 200 years earlier in Samos. This man was named, what was his name? Epicurus, that's his name, Epicurus, I have it right here. This is the thing, when you get to be my age, the great danger of doing anything like this is that my mind will go blank at some point, and then I'm just shot. But I know you love me. It'll be all right. So Epicurus was born on Samos, but he moved on to Athens and became a pretty well-known philosopher. And he was not a stupid guy, he was a pretty bright guy. And he looked at sort of the way life is, and he thought, well, I don't exist, and then I'm born and I do exist, and then I don't exist. I have a little brief time in this incredible universe to actually be alive on this planet, in this universe. And he thought, what is the most important thing a person could do with that little brief bit of time? And he thought, enjoy it. Enjoy it. Enjoy your little brief time. Have a good time. Have some pleasure in your life. Have some joy in your life. Follow your bliss. And along with that, try to have the least pain possible. Now, I've just described the way most of us live, haven't I? We want to have as much pleasure as we can, and we want to have the least pain we can. Isn't that right? See, we're all Epicureans. So far. Epicurus was a simple man. And for him, pleasure, though a wonderful pleasure, was sitting at home with some philosopher friends, having a conversation about philosophy into the night, drinking a little red wine. And I thought when I read that, wow, that's just about as good as it gets, to get together with good friends, not too many good friends, because, you know, I don't like a big crowd, but some good friends, friends who you could be honest with, you could tell the truth to, you could share your heart with, they would listen. Some people who would not only talk, but also listen. That's as good as it gets. That's about as good as it gets. You're thinking, what could be better? Or playing a game of tennis with a good friend, him letting you win now and then. Playing a little bridge with good friends, and they let you win now and then. Not too often, but now and then. reading a good book, seeing a good movie like The Sting, hiking in the Grand Canyon, hiking down to the river, having a good, loving, intimate relationship with someone you really, really, really love. That's good. That's good. Now, I want to warn you a little bit about maximizing pleasure, because that's where the pain thing comes in. Sometimes we have a kind of pleasure which quickly slips into pain. Many of you have that experience. Pain, quickly going to pain. Don't pass go, don't collect $200, pain, because the pleasure was a little bit awry. So that's a kind of a warning to you, just don't go crazy on the pleasure stuff. Now I want to leap forward about 300 years to around 50 BC, and a man named Lucretius. Lucretius wrote a poem. The poem is in this book. It's in English in this book, a 7,000 line poem describing the way things are. The name of the poem is On the Nature of Things. It's such beautiful Latin poetry. Those of you who know Latin really well probably want to read it now. But it was famous throughout antiquity. People loved it. They loved it for the beauty of the Latin, even if they didn't agree with everything that was in the poem. So I invite you to read it in English. You can get this at Barnes & Noble, by the way, and work your way through it. But the poetry in English leaves a bit to be desired, you know, translation being what it is. So in that poem, he describes the nature of things. That's the name of the poem, The Nature of Things, as he sees it as an Epicurean. He's a very devoted Epicurean. So now I want to give you just a few points from that poem about Epicureanism, so now you will know a little bit more than just the thing about pleasure. First, everything that is made of atoms. 50 BC, everything that is made of atoms. Atoms are the tiny little things that you can't see, but they are the building blocks of everything that is. And atoms are eternal. Atoms don't go away. And get this, atoms are the only thing that are eternal. Nothing else is eternal. Atoms come together, they form something, like they form me or you or your dog or the mountains or the planet or the galaxies. All of those things are formed by atoms coming together and forming them. It's kind of haphazard. But what a magnificent haphazardness it is. All you do is look around you. The nature of things, unbelievable, unbelievable wonder. And so the next thing is that the universe, therefore, has no creator or designer. The universe is caused by atoms in their haphazard fashion coming together and forming things and things being formed. Then all of those things that are formed by the atoms go away. Not some of them, all of them go away. Nothing is permanent, nothing is eternal except the atoms. The atoms remain, form different things, form new things. I stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon and remembered as I stood there that one time where there now is a 5,000 foot hole in the ground, one time there was a 12,000 foot range of mountains there, gone. Those atoms came together and then they came apart. So it is with everything. No creator, no designer, not even an intelligent designer. If you look at the head of a rhinoceros, someday look at the head of a rhinoceros real close and you'll know there was no intelligent designer. It's pretty amazing. The universe then was not created for us humans. Somebody wrote an essay in the past sometime, I forget where, and they made the case that the universe was made for geese. And that makes just as much sense as it was made for us. We are one of the things that atoms come together to form. And we, like everything else, are going to pass away. Not only us individually, and I'm pretty close to that point myself of, you know, passing on across, but everything will come apart. Everything. And the soul, whatever you mean by the soul, maybe you mean the psyche, maybe you mean the ego, maybe you mean the superego, maybe you mean just your sense of self. Whatever you mean by that word soul, it dies when you die. It's formed by the atoms, just like the rest of you. And when you die, that goes away. Therefore, there is no afterlife. No afterlife. I'll let that settle in for a moment. And I want to remind, if I was speaking to Methodists, I'd hasten to say, I'm telling you what Lucretius believed. And in fact, in the time of Lucretius, there were people, many religions were abroad in the Roman Empire, and there were many people who had been taught that when you died, if you hadn't lived quite right, you might go to some place and burn forever. This was before Jesus. People had that kind of religion was around. I know that's hard to believe that anybody would believe that, but a lot of people did. We've gotten, you know, wiser now. But for those people who thought, my goodness, when I die, I might go into this horrible torment. Death was a fearful thing. So now, those people were delighted. Ho, we're set free. We just die and then we're not anymore. So we're not going to burn anywhere. We're not going to get in golden streets to walk on either, but we simply will not exist. And that was good news to those folks. Lucretius is famous for saying, death means nothing to us. Death means nothing to us. For we are just like everything else. We come into being and we go out of being. What is the deal? Everything. We are in a huge company of those which pass away. And this is a little harsh, but let's put it this way. All religions are superstitious delusions. All religions. No, you people, they're not religious. I never get that. Don't worry about that. I'm not hurting your feelings. All religions are superstitious delusions. Because if you have a chance to live according to the nature of things and see the nature of things, and then somebody comes up with some kind of story that draws you away from that and cause you to live in some kind of fairy world, and that's superstitious delusion, and also it's cruel. It is cruel to lead somebody away from the opportunity to live life according to the nature of things and lead them into some fairyland. So all religions are, by nature, superstitious delusions and are cruel. Then I know there's another one here. Oh yes, this one, I mentioned this, didn't I? The highest achievement of the human being is pleasure. To have optimized the pleasure in your life and minimize the pain in your life. And now this is the part I like the best. If you live according to the nature of things, if you take away the blinders, take away the rose-colored glasses, take away the superstitions that your mother might have taught you, and see life the way it really is, look at it the way it really is, then you will be awestruck. You will be awestruck. You will not live an awful life. You will live a full of awe life. You will not live a superficial life. You will live a profound life. All you have to do is open your eyes and look around you, and the wonder and the mystery. You might, if you do this, you might even fall in love with mystery. You might. Now let's jump forward about 300 years. The Christian faith now has become the official religion of the Roman Empire, which was everybody in the West. A strange thing happened. Now, if you understand this, someday come and talk to me and explain it to me, but I don't understand how it could happen. Jesus, from what little bit we know about him, and by the way, forget the Gospel of John. Take the first three Gospels, the first Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and look in there for the things that seem authentic, and you find the parables in there, which for the most part have an authentic ring. Jesus probably said most of those things. The author of those books sometimes tries to explain it, put away that part, let just the parable stand on its own, or the, some like a Sermon on the Mount, things like this, which can be attributed to Jesus. Those things. From what we can tell of that, Jesus is a pretty regular guy. He had good male friends, he had good female friends, he went to weddings, he drank enough so that people said he drank too much. Kind of common guy, normal guy, and said some wonderful things, talked to people about how life really was and gave them an opportunity to be alive. Then, in the early church, they forgot all of that. They put all of that on a far, far back burner and talked only about what? His suffering. His suffering, his death, his resurrection. That was it. You read those books by Paul. That's the earliest stuff we have about the church. Read those books and see if you find in there any mention of Jesus' teachings. Already, they've abandoned the teachings like we have today. You notice that, don't you? And concentrating on the fact that he died for us, that he saved us by his death, that this God in the sky sent his own son down to die. And it gets to be very somber. It gets to be a very big focus on suffering. Isn't that something? Pleasure? Now we folks are on suffering. The very opposite. Maximize suffering in your life, minimize the joy. So early on, like Saint Benedict, there's a story of his, he thought he was walking along, he thought about a woman, thought about what pleasure might be involved there, and he immediately repented of that, took his clothes off, rolled in the briars and brambles until he was covered with blood, to get that pleasure business out of his system. Saint Teresa is reputed to have done exactly the same thing. To get to be a saint, maybe you had to do that. In the monasteries, there was many, many illustrations of people being flogged until blood was flowing on the floors. Now, a woman in those days might come to her priest and she might say to him, my husband's beating me almost every day. I think he's going to kill me. And the priest might say to her, Jesus suffered. Our Savior suffered. You have the privilege of joining in his suffering. I think that's rare. That wasn't rare. Now, I want to, perhaps you figure this one out. Why is it that our Mother Church hates artificial birth control? You know now, don't you? Because with artificial birth control, you could have sexual relations just for fun. Nobody wants that. There was another form of pleasure I told my wife I might mention, but she told me not to mention it, so so I won't mention it, even in this pulpit, which is relatively free. But who knows, I might want to be Surgeon General of the United States someday. Again, you see, you young people miss it, don't you? Sorry, that's the price you pay. Now, let's go forward. How are we doing, Garnet? Yeah, we have about 10 more minutes. Okay. I counted from when we actually started the service. So we jump forward now about to the 15th century. And there's a pope named John the 23rd, 15th century. Did you know that? If you're young, you don't remember the real John the 23rd, who was in the early 60s. That the John 23rd that I knew and loved started his reign as pope in the in 1958. I was very young at that time. The problem with that pope was that he was a scoundrel. A scoundrel, a murderer, a poisoner, a horrible human being. So he was exiled from and defrocked and put in jail. He had a man who worked for him in the Curia who was very, very good at copying and was very interested in the works of antiquity. That man's name was Poggio. He joined other people called, don't let this get boring for you, this is all right. He joined other people called the classicists who in the 15th century were searching for the works of antiquity. Everybody knew that back in antiquity, there were hundreds of thousands of unbelievably fine works of art and works of poetry and articles about theology, wonderful things. They were all gone, almost all gone. The Christian church destroyed many of them. Many of them just rotted away. Worms ate them. That's what bookworms do. They eat books. I don't know if you knew that. They were almost all gone. Lucretius's poem, gone. For a thousand years, gone. Nobody could find it. You could read in some of the works of antiquity, and they mentioned Lucretius's poem, but nobody had the poem. No one for a thousand years. Now you can imagine that the church had worked very, very hard over these thousand years to eliminate any memory of Epicureanism and done very, very good job at that. And that's why you sitting here this morning, until now, until this very moment, you've never heard a good word about Epicureanism in your life. But today, you hear a few things that are good. So they, because of that anti-Epicureanism, Lucretius' poem was gone. So Poggio, though, went up to a monastery in Germany, and monasteries were the one place where they saved some of this stuff. They prided themselves, many of them prided themselves on having a good library. So he went up to this monastery, and lo and behold, he found Lucretius' poem. He brought it back to Florence, he made copies of it, and then after a while, in short order, the printing press came into being, and Lucretius' poem was everywhere. Now, Stephen Goldblatt, who wrote the book that's on the front of your cover, and I encourage you to read that, and you'll know far more than I'm able to tell you this morning. But Stephen Goldblatt makes the case that it was the discovery of Lucretius' poem that was a major factor in the birth of the modern age. Now, to the final thing. Yeah, you can relax now. Now we go up to 1826, 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson died, to the day. And they inventoried his library, and guess what? He had 5 copies of Lucretius's poem in Latin, 1 copy in English, 1 copy in French, and 1 copy in Italian. Thomas Jefferson was a lover of Lucretius. And now you think, well, when Thomas got around to writing the Declaration of Independence, and he's trying to think of 3 things to mention that would be every person's right, well, life, everybody has a right to life, shouldn't be treated cheaply. Liberty, everybody has a right to gripe and moan. That's what we love, that's our liberty we love the most, is griping and moaning about things. Everybody has a right to get together in groups. Everybody has a right to say what they believe. Everybody has a right to think freely. And what's the third one going to be? The right to suffer? Apparently, he didn't think of that one. We all suffer. I don't make light of that. We all suffer, and some of us suffer immeasurably. That comes, but everybody wants the least suffering they can have. No, he chose for the third one, happiness. The pursuit of happiness. We all have a right to pursue the possibility of being happy, of enjoying our life, of having a good time, of playing some good bridge. Everybody. So he said, I don't know what, I think the church was either not as powerful in those days in this country as it is now. Otherwise, he could never have gotten it past the church. But lo and behold, it's been there all these years, and nobody knew that it was Lucretius who wrote that. It was Lucretius's influence that put that word in there for Thomas Jefferson. And so he got a letter from a friend just before he died. And if the friend said, Tom, what is your philosophy of life? And he wrote back, and we have the letter. He wrote back and said, I'm an Epicurean. Good enough for him. Thank you. Now, for our closing words, I'm going to let Doris Day speak to you.